Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, an associate professor in classics and ancient history from La Trobe University. This is episode CCXXII and part 3 of the Catiline Conspiracy, a stolen election. Catiline attempted to become consul of Rome more than once, and it's a position he believes he deserves. When he fails in his efforts and Cicero is elected, he attempts to force the issue, conspiring with all those who have a grudge against the state. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
In 64 BCE, probably around the middle of the year, we have the election for the consulship of 63 BCE, and Catiline runs. He tried to run before, remember, and he was disallowed. But he definitely runs for the consulship of 63. This is the year that, spoiler, Cicero is going to be one of the consuls. So even though he's a rival of Cicero, there are actually going to be three candidates and only two of them can be consul, he might initially have been supported by Cicero. Because what we do know about Cicero is that because he was a new man, novus homo, came from a family that hadn't had consuls in it before, he needed the support of traditional elites to get into power.
Yeah.
Because without going into too much detail, the elections were stacked so that elites' votes were worth more. But because it's not just one, it's not just like, you know, the election to be president, you don't have a joint president.
No, you've got two consuls.
Then you could potentially form an alliance. And it's thought, and we don't have concrete evidence on this, that Cicero might have thought it would be a good look for him to be balanced out, a bit like, I guess, American presidential candidates do with their vice presidential candidate.
Yeah,
they think,
I need
someone who appeals to that particular social group.
I need somebody more conservative to help me out, or
exactly.
More traditional. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. And Catiline, of course, comes from the most patrician of families, so he's a good balancing act for Cicero.
Mm.
But it looks like, and again, I stress, we don't have direct evidence, that if this is the case, Catiline was the one who turned Cicero down and said, no, I don't need you.
Mm.
So we don't have them running together. They are in opposition. And this is the point at which, and we've been using bits of this evidence, Cicero writes the speech, which is on the white toga, in other words, on candidature, where he has a go at Catiline. But remember, we've only got little snippets of that speech.
Yeah.
And we've only got it in quotations from Asconius, the commentator on Cicero. And we've been using them to fill in evidence for what Catiline was like before.
Okay.
But we should remember, whenever we've used that, it's from a context where he's attacking Catiline. And he's standing against him for the consulship. So he has reason to do so, seeing as they're not running as a pair.
Okay. So Cicero wins that election.
Along with Gaius Antonius Hybrida, usually known as Antonius, even though that's potentially confusing with Mark Antony. Yep. And indeed, he is Mark Antony's uncle.
Okay. All right. There's a lot of recycling of names in ancient Rome.
So in Roman terms, 63 BCE, when they are consuls together, it's the one I always read out because I can remember it when I'm talking to my students, is the year of the consulship of Cicero and Antonius.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Cicero becomes consul. Is that the year that Cicero is the main consul and Marcus Antonius is essentially a seat filler?
Yes, he is. And that's because Cicero is very clever about it in that he says, okay, Antonius, after your year of consulship, the traditional thing is, although Cicero doesn't seem to do it immediately, is that you'll go and be governor, proconsul of one of our colonies. And I'm going to make sure you get a plum colony.
Yeah.
If you do everything I want you to.
And then you can make a lot of money and retire happily and et cetera. Good.
Exactly.
In the meantime, you've got Catiline, who is spitting chips over the fact that he lost potentially yet again to a new man.
Yeah, it's humiliating for him to lose to a new man. This is where the evidence comes from, or at least the feeling that he might already be starting a conspiracy. We have Sallust talking as if this happens, as we'll get to that. So as if even here conspiracy is starting.
Mm-hmm.
But he decides to run for the following year. So those two factors, and I think I might have mentioned this before, are kind of in conflict. If we're already starting a conspiracy, why would we stand for the consulship? And there are different thoughts on that. So even though I would say that in this episode, we've got a little more concrete information than the last one, where, remember, I set up a whole conspiracy, an uprising, which may or may not have happened.
Yeah.
We're on more solid ground here. Nevertheless, exactly when things started is debated.
But I can see the logic and almost the merit in establishing a narrative, i.e. beginning a conspiracy, in anticipation that you might lose.
Yes, and that is the argument for Catiline already getting groups together.
Mm. So we are now in the year 63 BCE, and Cicero is the consul, and Catiline is running again. How does his election campaign look this time around?
Well, even though he has sort of thrown aside Cicero, who is now going to be running this election as consul, he's technically in charge of it, he does have lots of powerful supporters, which is maybe another reason, I'm just throwing this in there, for thinking that the conspiracy is not started yet, because he has actually...
a pretty good chance.
Well, yeah. I mean, he comes from the right family. He's got elite and powerful senators on his side, including Quintus Catulus, who is, you know, not known for being a rebel himself and certainly a power broker. He seems to have loads of money. There's always talk about maybe Crassus was funding him.
Mm.
And in the background of all of this, as we mentioned last time, is that if there are factions settling or getting together, it's not necessarily just popularis, you know, getting popular support versus optimates, let's keep power in the Senate. Cicero always on the side of the optimates.
Yeah.
But also, who's going to stop Pompey, or, you know, a certain number of us want to stop Pompey from having overwhelming power? He's having so much success in the East. He's getting so much money out of it, so much authority. We're always wanting a balancing act for when he comes back. And Crassus, who quite soon, in fact, will end up making a pact with Pompey, at this point might have been trying to stop him getting all of that power.
Mm.
And if he can get the next consul on side by paying for him, maybe he's doing that.
Okay.
It might not have been Crassus, but
yeah,
that is a theory that is often run.
Was that the whole platform that he was running on, was he?
No. He has a platform that's very controversial and is much more popularis. And indeed, if you think Crassus was backing him, then this is a bit weird, because one of the main planks of his platform is debt cancellation. In other words, if you have massive debts, then I'm going to get rid of them. I'm just going to write them off. Crassus has loads of money because he's lending out lots of money.
But doesn't Catiline have lots of debt?
Catiline does have debt, yes.
Okay, I'm noticing something here.
That he's self-interested?
Yeah.
But it's not only self-interested, and that is something I think that we need to bear in mind. And I think in the past, especially if you just read Sallust, you don't really get the full context. It's something that Barbara Levick is very keen on repeatedly reminding us of, which is it's not just Catiline. He might become a figurehead or the person who gets kind of attached to a conspiracy.
Yeah.
But this has been bubbling along for a while. And one of the main problems for Romans, well, the two big problems, and they are connected, are huge amounts of debt for individuals and a lack of land, both for veterans and for people who would have expected to have land and, you know, there's nowhere for them to go.
Yeah.
So land reform and debt cancellation, these have long been popularis policies.
Mm.
And they're what Catiline decides to take on, especially the debt cancellation. Some people say he also said, and we brought this up last time, that he was going to proscribe the rich. In other words, that they would have to give up their property and that their names would be on a list where they could be killed, which I think is very unlikely that Catiline did that.
Yeah.
Because it had such terrible kind of trauma in Roman minds after the civil war between Sulla and Marius, where so many Romans were proscribed. I think that's one of the things that is attached to him because he's seen as a bogeyman. But certainly his policy was that we will, depending on how you see it, help people out who are in terrible debt, or get rid of all this debt, and therefore those who would have been enriched by the payment of it are going to lose out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, what are you doing to the economy? Just cancelling all the debt. It's still a live debate.
Yeah, yeah. It also cancels a lot of leverage as well. So what did Cicero, the current consul, think of this impending idea?
He hated it, because Cicero, now he's consul, is very much in line with what the optimates want, those who already have power and money, and consolidating that power. And some people think that's how he got to have the consulship, by promising that he wasn't going to rock the boat, or it may have just been how he felt about what should happen. He felt this was a good policy. He had started his year as consul by actively quashing a land reform bill, that other plank of the Popularist politicians. So a man called Rullus had attempted to introduce one. If we know anything about Roman history, we know this has been attempted many times. It often ends in the murder of a tribune. Yeah. It didn't this time, but Cicero made sure that that never went forward. He has put his standard up as very much on the optimates side, and this debt cancellation is like red rag to a bull for him. So he's going to work towards Catiline not being elected, and that probably did not help Catiline. Well, almost certainly did not help him, because instead two people we probably have never heard of, well, maybe one of them, Decimus Junius Silanus and Lucius Licinius Murena, win the election. They will be the consuls of 62. So Catiline has lost again. He has now potentially lost three times if he did try and go for that consulship the first time around in that, was there a conspiracy or wasn't there? And basically his choices are now considered limited. He's in lots of debt, and his creditors are going to be calling in those debts, because if he got to be consul,
he could have cancelled his debt. He could be prosecuted.
He could have cancelled his own debts, yeah. Or he's going to start making money, so they think he's good for it. His supporters are running riot in the streets. Levick says his choices are suicide, bankruptcy, and social death, or exile in the provinces. So that's pretty stark.
Or conspire to overthrow the government.
Yeah. He may even be at physical risk, because Metellus Celer, a very powerful man, does take pity on him and takes him in, literally takes him into his house after Cicero's refused to do so.
Mm.
So he's kind of a social outcast at this point.
So now we're at the point where I think we can say that if it hasn't already, the Catiline conspiracy is fully established.
Yes. There is a conspiracy, an insurrection getting underway, planned for late October in 63 BCE.
Mm.
All right, so Cicero's still consul. It's just that we now have the elections decided. Even here, though, some scholars, and quite recently, have debated exactly what the chronology is. So, for example, in 2019, John Ramsey, well-known Roman historian, and he's not alone, argues that the conspiracy began before the elections were completed. So going along with the Sallust line, or the implied Sallust line.
Yeah.
And part of the argument over this, and I am going to get a tiny bit technical here, but I promise not to get into all of the weeds, is that there's a kind of general agreement amongst ancient historians that after Sulla, elections for the consulship were held in July in the previous year. But John Ramsey says this is never fixed, and it's just become a kind of understood wisdom without real proof of that. And he says the election for the consulship of 62 was actually held in September 63. He's got this complicated technical argument based on the chronology of Cicero's speeches, which we don't need to go into. Partly he bases it on the fact that the elections had to be postponed because of Catiline's threats of violence. So he's already making threats of violence. Therefore, the elections aren't held in July. And Ramsey says he can prove that based on what's in Cicero's speeches.
Yeah.
They were actually held in September. And I guess he's using this partly to say there was already a plan, or at least threats of violence, at mid-year.
Yeah, I get you, because it compresses the timeline to a matter of days of what
there
is
weeks.
To happen. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Catiline was accused of threatening Servius Sulpicius Rufus, who was a law expert, and he was going to be prosecuted by Cato. So we know that that had gone on.
Yeah.
So that may well be the background to a delay in the elections and a suspicion that Catiline is already planning something. There's a difference, I feel, between planning a conspiracy and shouting insults at somebody that you're going to, I don't know, smash their head in or whatever. Sorry, I know that sounds horrible. But I mean, it's not a nice thing to do, but it's not the same as overthrowing the state.
No, but you went from 0 to 10.
Do you want me to rephrase it?
No. I just saw the true Rhiannon.
I've had a tough background.
Okay. Wrong side of Wales. Okay, so
literally. And we do know that Catiline was, can I carry on with that?
Bad? No. I'm not editing. Go.
Catiline was summoned to the Senate to explain what are called his revolutionary words.
Yeah.
Threatening somebody who's high up in government or in government policy. And he said, these are his famous words, "There are two Romes. One thin and wasted with a weak head, the other strong, but as yet without a head.
Oh, okay.
And what he seems to mean by that is the Rome that's thin and wasted is the Senate, the state led by Cicero.
It's a dig at Cicero,
exactly. Yeah. Maybe compounded by the fact that he doesn't have a military career, but I'm just reading that into that.
Yeah.
The latter, the one that is strong but as yet without a head, are the people. All right, so this is a popularis statement.
Okay.
So it's the Senate versus the people of Rome, not the Senate and the people of Rome. And who's the head? Well, does he mean Pompey or does he mean, not being too modest, Catiline myself? He leaves it, as many intelligent politicians do who are making these kind of implications, they kind of say it without quite saying it.
It's just all implied stuff.
Mm. Another thing we do know about the elections, which gives you an idea of how things had got in 63, and I always think of the 50s BC as being the time when we have kind of chaos in the streets.
Yeah.
But in 63 BCE, in a very pointed way, very showy way, Cicero wears a breastplate under his toga and he makes sure it's seen, which is like, an I'm in danger. I'm brave enough to go out there, but look at the situation here. It's very precarious.
Yeah, but possibly warranted, honestly.
Maybe, I think it's long been warranted in Rome in some ways. We've had decades of people being murdered for their policies.
Hit with table legs and what have you.
Mm.
That's a thing, isn't it? I'm not misremembering.
Yeah,
that
that's one of the Gracchi.
You've alluded to Sallust being one of the best / most extensive / most dubious sources on the Catiline conspiracy. So what is it saying at this point? Is there a conspiracy in its pages?
He pretty much implies that there definitely is, because if you think about Sallust's chronology, and he has not helped things by having a flashback, which we talked about in the last episode, to that maybe first conspiracy. Well, in chapters 23-5, he talks about the conspirators, and then he only talks about the candidature, so the election for consulship, after that. So he talks as if there's already a conspiracy without actually saying it, but he strongly implies it throughout.
Mm.
So that idea that these people have already been primed for conspiracy, because I've already mentioned that they are the conspirators even before I get to talking about the election. So he strongly implies that everything was set up for an insurrection before those elections. And he gives us these, I think they're great, these kind of character attacks of four of the people who were involved. And two of them were women, so we don't often get that. So this is kind of fun,
yeah.
But also, you know, he's really taking them down. This is not a full list. We will find others when we get deeper into it.
Yeah.
But these are the ones he tells us about at this point. First of all, Quintus Curius. I'm going to give some extensive quotes here, but I'm going to kind of comment on them as I go,
because
I think they're fun. This is chapter 23 of the War of Catiline, or Conspiracy of Catiline, if you want to follow along. In that conspiracy was Quintus Curius, a man of no mean birth. He's high born, but Catiline is as well, but guilty of many shameful crimes. Oh, what a surprise. These are all dreadfully immoral people.
Mm.
And we know, actually, there's proof that he is guilty of shameful crimes, because the censors had expelled him from the Senate because of his immorality. So this is, for anyone who doesn't know, the role of the censor, which is possibly the only thing that's a higher appointment than consul, and it was usually for 5 years, not just 1 year. Well, one of your big roles is you get to look through the role of the Senate and say, literally put a black mark beside some names.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
This person no longer meets the 1 million sesterces requirement. Out.
But this guy here, Quintus, was immoral.
Yeah, that also.
Okay.
Behavior that you consider immoral. Most famously, Cato the censor was famous for being very strict on this. Put the black mark there and they're out. They can kind of interpret that any way they want, the censors. And there are a lot of expulsions at this point. So
even though
Quintus Curius maybe was immoral, he wasn't alone.
Quintus Curius, caught shagging in the back row of the Senate, is no longer allowed in there. And therefore he has an axe to grind.
Yes, that's not what Sallust says, but it's potentially...
I would love
we don't know the reason. It could have been almost anything. Sallust doesn't tell us, unfortunately, what that immorality was. Maybe he didn't know, or maybe he just doesn't want to lay it out.
Yeah.
He continues, this man was no less irresponsible than he was reckless. this is like a bad report card, isn't it?
Mm.
He had no concern at all about keeping secret what he had heard or concealing even his own misdeeds. This is a bad man to have in your conspiracy if he can't keep secrets.
Yeah.
He had a long-standing illicit love affair with Fulvia.
Okay. I know that name. Probably not that Fulvia, Mark Antony's wife. She would have been too young at this point.
It's not the Fulvia who was married to not only Mark Antony, but two other tribunes of the people.
Yeah.
On the right side of politics. And actually, maybe from the same family that was a popularis-type family.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we don't know much more about her except what Sallust tells us. We do have a little bit more information about Curius from elsewhere. Appian, Book 2, Chapter 3 of the Civil War, says that he'd been thrown out of the Senate in 70 BCE for many disgraceful deeds, says Appian. We get from Asconius, but remember this means it's probably from Cicero, that he was a notorious gambler and was later convicted on an unknown charge.
That's immoral in Rome.
Yeah, immoral. Would it get you thrown out of the Senate? I mean,
if you do it in the Senate, during the Senate.
You might be in debt. So that would be bad.
Yeah.
So who is Fulvia? Well, Sallust tells us in the same chapter, she was a woman of high birth. And when Curius began to lose favor with her because poverty compelled him to be less lavish, he suddenly fell to boasting. So basically, this tells us a lot about Fulvia. She wants gifts presumably lavished on her. And when he no longer has the money to do this, he has to make up for it in other ways. And he does it by boasting. And what do you think he's going to be boasting about? He does it indirectly at first, I guess, by beginning to promise her heaven and earth in the translation. But literally in Latin, it is the seas and the mountains, which I think is more poetic. And sometimes to, this is nasty, probably needs a trigger warning, in fact, because it's pretty violent behavior. Sometimes he threatens her with steel if she did not bow to his will. He's pretty toxic.
Yeah.
He's kind of half under her thumb and wanting to impress her and half being violent towards her.
Yeah, this is not a good relationship.
In brief, he behaved more boldly than he had been accustomed to. But Fulvia, when she learned the cause of Curius's unusual behavior, did not keep hidden such a peril to her country. But withholding the name of her source, she told a great many people what she had heard about Catiline's conspiracy.
Okay, so it will unravel because of these two, by the sounds of it.
Yes, exactly. So the way Sallust characterizes her is kind of surprising, and he does that a bit with the women he occasionally mentions, in that Fulvia is, well, she's having an affair, so that's, you know, that puts her beyond the pale for an elite woman in Roman society. And she wants lots of gifts from Curius. But when it comes to danger to the state itself, he says her reason for telling is that she wants to save the state from that peril. So it's not just, oh, I've got a juicy rumor, but Rome is in danger.
Yeah.
So I'm going to tell people. This kind of danger to the state is, some people think, the reason Cicero gets elected in the first place, that there's this general feeling that there might be something rumbling, so we need a safe pair of hands.
Yeah.
Something Cicero would like to feed into. So he creates that impression.
All right, so that's the in favour of the conspiracy going on a lot longer than...
Oh, certainly the forces that lead to the conspiracy. General discontent, grievance. All right, it doesn't come from nowhere.
Mm.
Interestingly, Diodorus tells us that the person Fulvia tells is Terentia, who is Cicero's wife. We don't get that in Sallust, though. Possibly is a fairly direct line to Cicero, the consul himself. The third person we get mentioned is Manlius. We don't get much information about him here, but he's going to feature really strongly in the narrative when we get to it of the war that will come from this.
Yeah.
Catiline starts sending him money and weapons. It's kind of what Sallust says about him at this stage.
Oh, this is the guy who raises the army?
Yes.
Okay.
So he is at Fiesole, which is in Tuscany. It's a lovely little place just outside Florence. Mm. Absolutely beautiful. But the center of war against Rome at this point. Yeah, he's the one who's supposed to start the armed conflict against Rome on the 27th of October. So we're going to see plenty of him.
Yeah.
Then we get not individuals, but what I've called generally scummy people and the enslaved. Well, that's how Sallust characterizes them, all right? So let me quote from the next chapter, chapter 24. At that period, Catiline is said to have gained the support of a great many men of all conditions, and even of some women, who had at first met their enormous expenses by prostituting themselves. He uses nasty words. They uses the word stuprum, which is the worst kind of sexual behavior. But later, when their time of life had reduced their incomes, i.e. they'd got older, but not their extravagance, they still want to be extravagant. He's really looking down on these women. They had run up enormous debt. Well, who is going to appeal to them at this point except the man who is saying he's going to cancel all debt? Through them, Catiline believed he could incite the city slaves. So he's actually got slaves involved now to an uprising to set fire to Rome. And as for their husbands, i.e. he's gone back to the women now, the indebted women, either attach them to his cause or kill them. So these women are going to kind of rile up the city slaves to be part of this uprising. And they're going to get their husbands on board with the conspiracy. Or if their husbands don't play ball, they'll just get rid of them. They'll kill them.
All right.
I mean, this is awful stuff and would really sound terrifying to the elite Roman audience reading this, that this whole idea of wives killing husbands and indeed slaves being violent is something that I think lives just beneath the surface for Romans, especially slave uprisings, because there are so many slaves.
Yeah.
There's this kind of weird tension between the slaves and the free in the city of Rome always.
Mm.
And Sallust really playing on that fear here. I've got one more little character assassination, and it is the best one. And one of the first pieces of Latin I ever read was this chapter.
What?
Just as an aside. It was in my textbook. This is chapter 25. And this woman, Sempronia, we never hear of her again, but she is brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, among these women, i.e. the ones who had been sex workers but had got themselves into debt, among these women was Sempronia, who had often committed many crimes of masculine daring.
Okay.
In birth and beauty, in her husband also and children, she was abundantly favored by fortune. And we do know that her husband was Decimus Junius Brutus, who had been consul in 77 BCE. He was the father of one of Caesar's assassins later, who has the same name, Decimus Junius Brutus. So not
the Brutus.
Not the Brutus.
But another Brutus.
But a different Brutus who was involved in the same act.
Right, okay.
Well, these families are all interrelated anyway, but she has that connection. She was well read in the literature of Greece and Rome, able to play the lyre and dance more skillfully than an honest woman needs to, and having many other accomplishments which minister to voluptuousness.
She sounds great.
She's the life and soul of the party. She's really clever.
I'm waiting for the shoe to drop.
Well, now she knows how to sing and dance, and no honest woman should know how to do that, at least not well.
So in the context of elite Rome, she's not great.
So it's not like, you know, in your classic Jane Austen drama where playing the piano is one of the accomplishments of a marriageable woman.
Mm-hmm.
This is something for the low, indeed the unspeakables, to be good at.
Okay.
All right. So this suggests that she entertains people by doing this, and this is inappropriate, and she's using her body to do it and all kinds of other things.
And she dances better than she should be able to. Yeah, yes.
Exactly.
Okay. Right.
But there was nothing which she held so cheap as modesty and chastity. She didn't care about them at all. You could not easily say whether she was less sparing of her money or her honor. He's really got it in for her.
Yeah, he's not a fan, eh?
Her lust was so heated that she sought men out more often than she was sought by them. Even before the time of the conspiracy, she had often broken her word, repudiated her debts, and been privy to murder. So being in debt, I think, is the really important bit here. He doesn't give us details of the murder.
Yeah.
Poverty and extravagance combined had driven her headlong. Nevertheless, she was a woman of no mean intellect. Despite being just the worst of the worst, she was a woman of no mean intellect. She could write verses, make jokes, and use language which was modest or tender or wanton. In short, she possessed a high degree of wit and charm.
Okay.
It's like he's been won over by her at the end.
Yeah, it's like, you know, she wasn't all bad.
And, you know, the fact that she could use language well, I mean, that's a characteristic of a Roman orator. Something men should be able to do. And remember, at the beginning, he said that she had masculine daring. It's like she's been born into the wrong gender. She's got all of these accomplishments, but she misuses them.
Okay.
The through line here is the people who join the conspiracy are in debt.
Since that is Catiline's main pitch, they would definitely want him to win, or at least to be in power, if he's continuing with those promises.
I think it is worth saying at this point, we should remember it's not just these individuals. Even though they're in debt, there is a much more general feeling of discontent and grievance at this point. And as I said before, it's something that Barbara Levick pushes very strongly. And she reminds us that it's not just that there's popular discontent, that, you know, people don't have enough land, that they feel aggrieved because of this. There's a huge amount of debt. But also that the attempts to put that right have been rejected for decades. The land distribution. I mean, it's now been, what, 60 years since the Gracchi, and we still haven't sorted out this problem.
Yeah.
Around this time, in fact, 63 is the year that this is happening, one of the tribunes of the plebs, Labienus, puts a man called Rabirius on trial. It's not a successful prosecution in the end. He's put him on trial for a murder of a tribune of the plebs. He hasn't murdered him in 63. This charge goes back to 100 BCE.
Wow, okay.
You'd think that
really dredging it up.
Yeah, it's like this need almost for vengeance, or the resentment hasn't gone away. He's using this opportunity now that he's tribune of the plebs to use his power for something that happened 37 years before. Cicero defends Rabirius. Mm. It is also the year that Caesar is elected as Pontifex Maximus, so the chief priest, which is one of the early-ish kind of huge power boosts that Caesar gets. And the reason it's thought that he got elected as Pontifex Maximus, because this is an elected position, is because Labienus, that tribune of the plebs, has changed the law. Now, Sulla had brought in a law that said that the current priests, the college of priests, get to vote on who becomes Pontifex Maximus. And Labienus transfers a lot of that power to the people.
Okay.
So Caesar, a popularis politician, as he's developing into, gets this huge, important, authoritative role based on the support of the people. There's the idea of kind of change happening this year. It's like a revolutionary year, that this is bubbling up under the surface. And so it's not surprising that support will go to Catiline when he finally gets together the uprising.
Okay, so we've got this well-established conspiracy, which, may I say, I'm quite impressed that it's an equal opportunity conspiracy.
Plenty of women involved, and even enslaved people, apparently.
Yeah, everyone. Everyone who's got an axe to grind with Rome can be involved in this conspiracy. But how does it begin to unravel?
I know I've been talking a lot about Levick here, but I think she puts it really well. She says, there were murmurs elsewhere than at Rome, and widespread evidence provides a formidable list from north to south of places and peoples outside Rome that were actually or potentially involved in the risings of 63, and so available to subversive elite leaders. So it's not just the rumor of the kind of fixed conspiracy, but all of these rumors circulating in this very kind of febrile time of little gatherings and uprisings happening throughout Italy. It was rumored that Catiline's co-conspirator and ex-Sullan centurion, Gaius Manlius, who we mentioned before, had raised an army in Etruria. So this is the rumor reaching Cicero at this point, that there's the army in Fiesole, in Etruria. And also that there is unrest in Arezzo, which is to the south of Rome. So we've got it happening to the north and the south, kind of sandwiching Rome in. Sallust says that Catiline arms the rebels there. So what is being implied here, and certainly what scholars like Levick take from this, is that he literally weaponizes the grievance that's already happening. He sees where there might be these pockets of uprising and resistance, and he gets the weaponry to them.
Yeah,
so it's not just in Rome at all. In fact, it doesn't start in Rome. It's potentially throughout the whole Italian peninsula.
That was Rhiannon Evans, an associate professor in classics and ancient history from La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you find your podcasts, leave a review, and tell your friends about it. You can follow the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. We are on what is left of Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. Or hey, you can send an email to emperorspodcast@gmail.com. Emperors of Rome is produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.